For if it was truly necessary to hand over the kingship to someone else and not keep it himself, it would have been more just to bestow this good fortune on one of the Medes rather than on the Persians. But as things stood, the Medes, who bore no responsibility for this, had become slaves instead of masters, while the Persians, who had once been enslaved to the Medes, had now become their masters instead. Astyages, then, having reigned 35 years, was thus deposed from his kingship, and the Medes submitted to the Persians because of his harshness, after having ruled over Asia beyond the Halys River for 128 years, apart from the time during which the Scythians ruled. Later, however, they came to regret having done this and revolted from Darius, but having revolted, they were again subdued, defeated in battle. At that time, then, under Astyages, the Persians together with Cyrus revolted and overthrew Median rule, taking control of Asia from then on. Cyrus did Astyages no further harm but kept him with him until he died. Thus Cyrus, born and raised as he was, became king and later subdued Croesus, who had begun the wrongdoing, as I have said before, and having subdued him, he ruled over the whole of Asia in this way. I know that the Persians observe customs such as these. It is not their custom to set up statues, temples, or altars. Indeed, they consider those who do so to be fools, because, as I think, they do not believe the gods to have human form as the Greeks do. They have a custom of going up to the highest peaks of the mountains and offering sacrifices to Zeus, calling the whole circle of the sky Zeus. They also offer sacrifice to the sun and the moon, to earth, fire, water, and the winds. From ancient times, these alone have received their sacrifices, but they have since learned also to sacrifice to heavenly Aphrodite, having learned this from the Assyrians and the Arabians. The Assyrians call Aphrodite Mylitta, the Arabians call her Alalat, and the Persians call her Mithra. As for sacrifice, the practice among the Persians regarding the gods I have mentioned is as follows. They build no altars and kindle no fire when they intend to sacrifice. They use no libation, no flute, no wreaths, no barley groats. When a man wishes to sacrifice to one of these gods, he leads the animal to a clean spot and calls upon the god, wearing his tiara wreathed most often with myrtle. It is not permitted for the one sacrificing to pray for good things for himself alone, but he prays for good things to come to all the Persians and to the king, for he himself is included among all the Persians. When he has cut the sacrificial victim limb from limb and boiled the meat, he spreads out the softest grass he can find, especially clover, and lays all the meat upon it. Once he has arranged it, a magus stands by and chants over it a theogony, for such is what they say the incantation is, for it is not their custom to make sacrifices without a magus present. After waiting a short while, the one who has sacrificed carries away the meat and uses it as he sees fit. They consider the day on which each of them was born to be the one most worthy of honor of all days. On this day, custom calls for laying out a feast more generous than usual. On it, the wealthy among them set out an ox, a horse, a camel, and a donkey roasted whole in ovens, while the poor among them set out the smaller kinds of livestock. They eat little in the way of solid food, but much in the way of dessert courses, and not all at once, which is why the Persians claim that Greeks leave the table still hungry, since nothing worth mentioning follows their dinner. Whereas if something more were served, they say, the Greeks would not stop eating. They are very devoted to wine, and it is not permitted for them to vomit or to urinate in front of another person. These customs, then, are observed strictly. It is their habit to deliberate on the most important matters while drunk, and whatever decision they reach in their deliberations, whoever heads the household where the discussion took place lays it before them again the next day while they are sober, and if the decision still pleases them sober, they act on it. But if it does not please them, they abandon it instead. And whatever they have deliberated first while sober, they reconsider while drunk. When they meet one another in the streets, one can tell whether those meeting are of equal rank by this. Instead of greeting each other verbally, they kiss each other on the mouth. But if one is of somewhat lower rank, they kiss each other on the cheeks. And if one is much lower in rank, he falls down and prostrates himself before the other. They honor most of all, after themselves, those who live nearest to them, and next those who live second nearest, and so on, honoring people in due proportion as they go further away. and they hold in least honor those who live farthest away from themselves, believing that they themselves are by far the best of all people in every respect, that other peoples partake of excellence in proportion to their nearness, and that those living farthest away are the worst. Under the rule of the Medes, the various nations also ruled over one another in this pattern. The Medes ruled over those nearest to them, and those people in turn over their neighbors, and those neighbors over the ones next to them. And by this same reasoning, the Persians too give honor, for the nation kept advancing as it ruled and governed. The Persians adopt foreign customs more than any other people. For example, having decided that Median dress is more beautiful than their own, they wear it, and in war they wear Egyptian breastplates. They also take up all sorts of pleasures as soon as they learn of them, and indeed, having learned it from the Greeks, they have relations with boys. Each of them marries many lawful wives and acquires even more concubines besides. Manliness is reckoned, after prowess in battle, to consist chiefly in this: whoever can show the most sons. Each year the king sends gifts to the man who has the most to show. They believe that numbers make for strength. They educate their boys, beginning at 5 years old and continuing to 20, in three things only: riding, archery, and telling the truth. Until a son turns 5, he is kept away from his father's presence entirely and spends his days among the women. This is done for this reason: they do this so that, if the child dies while being raised, it will cause the father no grief. Now I praise this custom, and I praise this one too, that not for a single offense will the king himself put anyone to death, nor will any other Persian inflict irreparable harm on any of his own servants for a single offense, but only after reckoning up, if he finds the wrongs to be more numerous and greater than the services rendered, does he then give way to his anger. They say that no one has ever yet killed his own father or mother, but that whenever such a thing has happened, it has always, upon investigation, been found without exception that the child was either a supposititious child or born of adultery. For they say it is not plausible that a true parent should die at the hands of his own child. Whatever their customs forbid them from doing, it is also not lawful for them to speak of. The most shameful thing among them, by their reckoning, is lying, and second to that is owing a debt, for many reasons, but chiefly because they say it is necessary for a debtor to tell lies as well. Any citizen who has leprosy or a white skin disease does not come down into the city and does not mix with the other Persians. They say he has this because he has sinned in some way against the sun. Many drive out of the country any foreigner who contracts these diseases, and they do the same with white doves, giving the same reason. They neither urinate nor spit into a river, nor wash their hands in one, nor do they allow anyone else to do so, but they hold rivers in the greatest reverence. And here is another thing that has happened to them, which has escaped the Persians themselves, but not us. Their names, which correspond to their bodily forms and to their grandeur, all end in the same letter, the one the Dorians call San and the Ionians call Sigma. If you search for it, you will find that the names of the Persians all end in this letter, without exception, not some but not others. This much I can say with certainty, knowing it for a fact about them, but the following is told as a secret and not clearly, concerning the dead, that the corpse of a Persian is left unburied until a bird or dog has dragged it off. That the Magi do this, I know for certain, for they do it openly. But the Persians coat the body in wax before laying it in the ground. The Magi are set apart greatly from other men, and also from the priests in Egypt. For the Egyptian priests hold it a point of purity to avoid killing any living thing except what they sacrifice. But the Magi kill with their own hands everything except a dog and a man, and they make it a great point of competition, killing ants and snakes alike, and other creeping and flying things. Well, let this custom be as it was originally established, and let me return to my earlier account. Now the Ionians and Aeolians, as soon as the Lydians had fallen to the Persians, dispatched envoys to Sardis to see Cyrus, wanting to be subject to him under the same terms on which they had been subject to Croesus. He, having heard what they proposed, told them a story. He said that a flute player, seeing fish in the sea, played his flute, expecting that they would come out onto the land. But when his hope was disappointed, he took a casting net and gathered up a great multitude of fish within it and drew them out. And seeing them leaping about, he said to the fish, "Stop dancing for me now, since when I was playing, you were not willing to come out and dance. Cyrus told this story to the Ionians and Aeolians for this reason. Earlier, when Cyrus himself had asked them through messengers to revolt from Croesus, they had not been persuaded, but now that matters had been settled, they were ready to obey Cyrus. He, in his anger, said this to them. When the Ionians heard this report carried back to their cities, they each built walls around their own cities, and the rest gathered at the Panionian, except for the Milesians. For with them alone did Cyrus make a treaty on the same terms the Lydian had made. As for the remaining Ionians, they decided by common resolution to dispatch envoys to Sparta asking the Spartans for aid on behalf of the Ionians. Now these Ionians, to whom the Panionian belongs, happen to have founded their cities in the finest part of the sky and climate of all the peoples known to us. The districts lying above Ionia are not its equal, nor are those beneath it, nor the parts toward the east nor those toward the west are like it, some being oppressed by cold and wet, others by heat and drought. They do not all use the same language, but four different varieties of speech. Miletus lies first among their cities toward the south, and after it Myus and Preene. These are settled in Caria and speak the same dialect to one another. The following are in Lydia: Ephesus, Colophon, Lebidos, Teos, Clazomene, Phocaea. These cities share no common speech with those mentioned earlier, but speak the same as one another. There remain three more Ionian cities, of which two are situated on islands, Samos and Chios, and one, Erythrae, is settled on the mainland. The Chians and the Erythraeans speak the same dialect, while the Samians alone speak their own. These make four distinct varieties of speech. Now of these Ionians, the Milesians were sheltered from fear, having made a treaty, and none of the islanders among them had anything to fear either, for the Phoenicians were not yet subjects of the Persians, nor were the Persians themselves seafarers. They had separated from the other Ionians for no other reason than this. At that time, when the whole Greek race was weak, the Ionian people was by far the weakest of its branches and of least account, for apart from Athens, there was no other city of note. So the other Ionians, and the Athenians too, shunned the label, preferring not to be called Ionians, and even now most of them seem to me to be ashamed of the name. But those 12 cities gloried in the name and founded a sanctuary for themselves alone, to which they gave the name Panionian, and they resolved to share it with none of the other Ionians. Nor did any others ask to take part except the Smyonians. Just as the Dorians of what is now the Pentapolis, though formerly called the Hexapolis, take care to admit none of their Dorian neighbors into the Triopian sanctuary, and indeed excluded from participation even some of their own number who had transgressed against the sanctuary. For in the contest of Triopian Apollo, they used to set out bronze tripods as prizes for the winners in ancient times, and those who won them were required not to carry them away from the sanctuary, but to dedicate them there to the god. Now a man of Halicarnassus, whose name was Agesicles, having won, disregarded this custom, and carrying the tripod off to his own house, nailed it up there. For this reason, the five cities, Lindos, Ialissos, and Cameros, along with Cos and Cnidos, shut the sixth city, Halicarnassus, out of the association. This is the penalty they imposed on the Halicarnassians. Now it seems to me that the Ionians made 12 cities and were unwilling to admit more for this reason, that when they lived in the Peloponnese, they too were divided into 12 parts, just as now the Achaeans who drove the Ionians out are divided into 12 parts. First Pellene, next to Sicyon, then Egira and Ege, where the river Crathys flows perennially, from which the river in Italy took its name, and Bura and Hellas, to which the Ionians fled when they were defeated in battle by the Achaeans, and Egium, Ripes, Patri, Pheri, and Olnus, where the great river Paris is, and Dyme and Tritea, the only ones of these that lie inland. These are now the 12 parts of the Achaeans, and were then the parts of the Ionians. For this reason, the Ionians too made 12 cities. Since to say that these Ionians are any more Ionian, or any nobler in origin, than the other Ionians would be great foolishness. For the Abants from Euboea are no small part of them, though they have no share at all in the name of Ionia, and Minyans from Orchomenus have been mixed in among them, and Cadmeans and Dryopians, and a scattered group of Phocians, and Molossians, and Arcadian Pelasgians, and Dorian men from Epidaurus, and many other peoples besides have been mixed in. And those of them who set out from the Athenian Prytaneum and consider themselves the noblest born of the Ionians did not bring wives with them to the colony, but took Carian women, whose parents they had murdered. Because of this murder, these women established a custom among themselves and bound each other by oaths, which they handed down to their daughters, never to eat at the same table as their husbands, nor ever to call their own husband by name, because the men had murdered their fathers, husbands, and children, and then, having done these things, took them as wives. This took place in Miletus. As kings, some of them set up men descended from Glaucus son of Hippolochus, of Lycian stock, others men of Caucon Pylian descent from Codrus son of Melanthus, and others both together. But because they cling to the name more strongly than other Ionians do, let those who are of pure Ionian descent be called Ionians too. All are Ionians who trace their origin from Athens and who celebrate the festival of the Apatrurea. All of them celebrate it except the Ephesians and the Colophonians. These alone of the Ionians do not celebrate the Apatrurea, and that on account of some charge of murder. The Panionian is a sacred place belonging to Mycale, facing north, set apart in common by the Ionians for Poseidon Heliconius. Mycale is a headland of the mainland facing west toward Samos, where the Ionians would gather from their cities and hold the festival to which they gave the name Panionia. It is not only the festivals of the Ionians that are affected this way, but likewise all the festivals of all the Greeks end in the same letter end in the same way as the Persian names do. These, then, are the Ionian cities. The Aeolian cities are these: Syme, which is called Phrycinus, Larissae, Neontikos, Temnos and Scylla, Notion and Egyrosa, Pitane and Aegea, Myrina and Grinia. 11 ancient Aeolian cities stand on this list, for one of their number, Smyrna, was taken from them by the Ionians. There had originally been 12 of them on the mainland as well. These Aeolians happen to have settled a better land than the Ionians, but their climate does not compare as favorably. This is how the Aeolians lost Smyrna. They had taken in some men of Colophon who had been defeated in civil strife and driven out of their homeland. Afterward, these Colophonian exiles waited until the Smyrnaeans were celebrating a festival of Dionysus beyond the city walls, then barred the gates behind them and took possession of the city. When all the Aeolians came to help, terms were agreed upon. The Ionians would give back the movable property, and the Aeolians would abandon Smyrna. When the people of Smyrna had done this, the 11 cities divided them among themselves and made them citizens of their own communities. These, then, are the mainland Aeolian cities, apart from those settled on Ida, for those are counted separately. Of the island cities, 5 share Lesbos between them, for the 6th city on Lesbos, Arisba, was enslaved by the people of Methymna, though its people were their own kin. On Tenedos 1 city is settled, and on the islands called the Hundred Isles another. For the people of Lesbos and Tenedos, as for the Ionians who hold the islands, there was no danger at all. But the remaining cities agreed together to follow wherever the Ionians should lead. When the envoys of the Ionians and Aeolians arrived at Sparta, for this business was being conducted with great speed, they chose to speak before all the others the man of Phocaea, whose name was Pythermus. He wrapped himself in a purple cloak, so that as many Spartans as possible would hear of it and gather to listen, and standing before them he spoke at length, asking for aid on their behalf. But the Lacedaemonians would not listen at all. They decided against helping the Ionians. So the envoys departed, but the Lacedaemonians, though they had turned away the Ionian envoys, nonetheless sent men in a 50-oared ship to spy out, as it seems to me, the affairs of Cyrus and of Ionia. When these men arrived at Phocaea, they sent to Sardis the most respected of their number, whose name was Lacrines, to declare to Cyrus the message of the Lacedaemonians, that he should do no harm to any city of Greek land, since they would not overlook it. When the herald had said this, it is said that Cyrus asked those Greeks present with him who these Lacedaemonians were, and what their numbers came to, that they should proclaim such a thing to him. And on learning the answer, he said to the herald, "Never yet have I feared the sort of men who keep a space marked out in the middle of their city where they gather to swear oaths and cheat one another. If I remain in good health, it will not be the sufferings of the Ionians that they will have to talk about, but their own troubles." Cyrus flung these words at the Greeks generally, because they set up marketplaces and conduct business by buying and selling. For the Persians themselves are not accustomed to use marketplaces at all, nor do they have any marketplace whatsoever. After this, he entrusted Sardis to Tabalus, a Persian and charged Pactais, a Lydian, with bringing away the gold that had belonged to Croesus and to the other Lydians, and he himself marched off to Ecbatana, taking Croesus with him and giving no thought at all to the Ionians for the present. Babylon stood in his way, as did the Bactrian nation, the Saki, and the Egyptians. Against these he intended to lead an army himself and to send some other general against the Ionians. But when Cyrus had marched away from Sardis, Pactais caused the Lydians to revolt from Tabalus and from Cyrus. Going down to the coast, since he had all the gold from Sardis, he hired mercenaries and persuaded the people of the coast to join him on campaign. Marching then against Sardis, he laid siege to Tabalus, who had been penned inside the Acropolis. When Cyrus learned of this on the road, he said the following to Croesus. "Croesus, what will be the end of these things happening to me? It seems the Lydians will not stop giving trouble, both to themselves and to me. I am wondering whether it would be best to enslave them outright. For it now appears to me that I have acted just as if a man, having killed the father, had spared the children. So it is with me. I have taken you, who were more than a father to the Lydians, and led you away captive, yet handed the city over to the Lydians themselves. And now I am surprised that they have revolted from me." So he spoke what he had in mind, and Croesus answered him thus, fearing that Cyrus might destroy Sardis utterly. "O king, what you have said is reasonable, but do not give way entirely to anger, nor destroy an ancient city that is innocent both of the former wrong and of what is happening now. For the former wrong I committed myself, and I bear the consequences on my own head. And as for what is happening now, it is Pactais who is doing the wrong, the man to whom you entrusted Sardis. Let him pay the penalty for it. But show mercy to the Lydians, and lay upon them this command, so that they neither revolt nor become dangerous to you. Send word barring them from owning any weapons of war, and command them to wear tunics under their cloaks and to put on soft boots, and bid them teach their sons to strum the lyre and pluck the harp, and to take up shopkeeping. And quickly, O king, you will see them turn into women rather than men, so that you need fear no revolt from them." Croesus suggested this to him, finding it more acceptable for the Lydians than being sold into slavery, knowing that unless he offered a sufficiently weighty reason, Cyrus would not be talked into changing his mind, and fearing also that the Lydians, if they should escape the present danger, might later revolt from the Persians and be destroyed. Cyrus was pleased with the suggestion, and relenting from his anger, said he would follow it. Calling Mazares, a Mede, he ordered him to proclaim to the Lydians what Croesus had proposed, and further to enslave all the others who had joined the Lydians in the campaign against Sardis, but to bring Pactais himself to him alive at all costs. Having given these orders on the road, he marched on toward the land of the Persians, but Pactais, learning that an army was approaching against him, took fright and fled to Syme. Mazares the Mede, marching against Sardis with whatever portion of Cyrus's army he had with him, and finding that Pactais and his followers were no longer in Sardis, first compelled the Lydians to carry out Cyrus's orders, and from that command, the Lydians changed their entire way of life. After this, Mazares sent messengers to Syme demanding that Pactais be handed over. The people of Syme decided to refer the matter for advice to the god at Branchidae, for there was an oracle established there from ancient times, which all the Ionians and Aeolians were accustomed to consult. This place is in the territory of Miletus, above the harbor of Panormus. The people of Syme, then, sent sacred envoys to the Branchidae and asked what they should do concerning Pactais to please the gods. When they asked this, the oracle's answer was to hand Pactais over to the Persians. When the people of Syme heard this report brought back, they set about doing so. But while the majority were inclined this way, Aristodicus, son of Heracleides, a man of standing among the citizens, prevented the Symeans from doing this, distrusting the oracle and thinking that the sacred envoys had not reported truly, until other envoys went a second time to inquire about Pactais, among whom Aristodicus himself was included. When they arrived at Branchidae, Aristodicus consulted the oracle on behalf of all, asking as follows: "Lord, Pactyes the Lydian has come to us as a suppliant, fleeing a violent death that the Persians intend for him, and they demand his surrender, ordering the Cimmeans to give him up. We, though fearing the power of the Persians, have not yet dared to hand over the suppliant, until it be made clear to us plainly by you which of the two we should do. So he asked, but the god again gave them the same oracle, ordering them to hand Pactyes over to the Persians. In response to this, Aristodicus did the following deliberately. Going around the temple in a circle, he removed the sparrows and all the other kinds of birds that had made their nests in the temple. As he carried this out, a voice reportedly came from the inner sanctuary directed at Aristodicus, saying, "Most impious of men, how dare you do this? Do you tear my suppliants out of the temple?" And Aristodicus, not at a loss for an answer, replied, "Lord, do you yourself come to the aid of your suppliants in this way, yet command the Cimmeans to hand over their suppliant?" And the god answered him again, saying, "Yes, I command it, so that by committing this impiety you may perish all the sooner, and not come again to the oracle in the future concerning the surrender of suppliants." When the people of Syme heard this report brought back, unwilling either to perish by surrendering him or to endure a siege while he stayed among them, they packed him off to Mytilene. But when Mazares sent messages demanding that they hand over Pactyes, the Mytileneans prepared to give him up in exchange for a certain payment. I cannot say exactly how much, for the matter was never completed. For when the Cimmeans learned that this was being carried out by the Mytileneans, they sent a boat to Lesbos and brought Pactyes away to Chios. From there, he was dragged out of the temple of Athena Polias by the Chians and handed over. The Chians gave him up in exchange for Atarneus, a district of Mysia opposite Lesbos. The Persians, once they had received Pactyes, kept him under guard, intending to present him to Cyrus. And for a long time afterward, no Chian would offer barley grains as a first offering to any god from that district of Atarneus, nor bake sacrificial cakes from its produce, and everything grown in that land was excluded from all religious offerings. So the Chians handed over Pactyes. After this, Mazares campaigned against those who had joined in besieging Tabalus, and he enslaved the people of Preen and overran the whole plain of the Meander. He overran the whole country, plundering with his army, and did the same to Magnesia. After this, he died shortly of illness. When he had died, Harpagus came down as his successor in command, a man who was himself Median by birth, the same Harpagus whom Astyages, the king of the Medes, had feasted at that unlawful banquet, and who had helped Cyrus win the kingship. This man, now appointed general by Cyrus, when he arrived in Ionia, began taking the cities by means of earthworks. Whenever he had shut the defenders up behind their walls, he would then pile up mounds of earth against the walls and so storm them. The first city of Ionia he attacked was Phocaea. These Phocaeans were the first of the Greeks to make long sea voyages, and it was they who opened up the Adriatic, Thessalonica, Iberia, and Tartessus. They sailed not in round ships, but in 50-oared galleys. When they arrived at Tartessus, they won the friendship of the Tartessian king, a man named Arganthonius. He had ruled Tartessus for 80 years and lived 120 years in all. This man became so fond of the Phocaeans that at first he urged them to leave Ionia and settle wherever they wished in his own country. But afterward, when he could not persuade the Phocaeans to do this, and learning from them how the Mede was growing in power, he supplied funds so they could raise a wall around their city, giving without stint. For the circuit of the wall is not a few stadia, and all of it is built of great stones well fitted together. In this way, the wall was completed for the Phocaeans. Harpagus, when he brought up his army, laid siege to them, but offered terms, saying it would satisfy him if the Phocaeans were willing to tear down just one bastion of the wall and consecrate just one house. The Phocaeans, indignant at the prospect of slavery, said they wished to deliberate for one day and would then give their answer. But while they deliberated, they urged him to pull his forces back away from the city wall. Harpagus said he knew well what they intended to do, but nonetheless he would allow them to deliberate. So while Harpagus withdrew his army from the wall, the Phocaeans in that time launched their 50-oared ships, put aboard their children, wives, and all their movable goods, and besides these the statues from their temples and the other dedications, except for whatever was of bronze or stone or painting, loading everything else aboard and embarking themselves, they sailed for Chios. the Persians took possession of Phocaea, now emptied of its men. But when the Chians would not sell the Phocaeans the islands called the Onyssi, even for payment, fearing that they might become a trading port and that their own island might thereby be shut out from trade, the Phocaeans for this reason set sail for Caenus, Corsica. For on Caenus, 20 years before this, they had founded a city in accordance with an oracle, whose name was Aelia. Arganthonius by this time was already dead. As they set out for Caenus, they first sailed back to Phocaea and slaughtered the Persian garrison that had taken over the city from Harpagus and was guarding it. After they had accomplished this, they laid strong curses upon any of their own number who might be left behind by the fleet. And beyond these curses, they also sank a lump of iron into the sea, swearing they would not come back to Phocaea until that lump of iron floated up again. Yet as they made for Caenus, more than half the citizens were overcome by longing and sorrow for their city and the customs of their homeland. Breaking their oath, they turned their ships around and sailed back to Phocaea. The rest, who kept the oath, weighed anchor from the Onyssi and sailed on. When they arrived at Caenus, they lived together with those who had come there earlier for 5 years, and they built temples. But since they were raiding and plundering all their neighbors, the Teucenians and Carthaginians made common cause and campaigned against them, each side with 60 ships. The Phocaeans, manning 60 ships of their own, meeting them out in the sea men call the Sardinian. Once the fighting began, the Phocaeans came away with something like a Cadmean victory. 40 of their vessels were wrecked, and the 20 ships left over were unfit for use, since their rams had been twisted out of true. Putting in at Aelia, they gathered up their children, their wives, and as much of their other belongings their ships were able to carry, and then, abandoning Caenus, sailed for Regium. As for the men of the destroyed ships, the Carthaginians and Teucenians divided them by lot, and among the Teucenians the people of Agila drew by far the largest share of them, and these they led out and stoned to death. Afterward, everything that passed by that place belonging to the Agileans, where the stoned Phocaeans lay, became distorted, crippled, and paralyzed, sheep, pack animals, and men alike. The Agileans sent to Delphi, wishing to atone for their wrongdoing, and the Pythia bade them do what the Agileans still perform to this day. They hold great funeral rites in their honor and establish athletic and equestrian contests. Such was the fate that befell these Phocaeans, but others of them fled to Regium, and setting out from there, they took possession of a city in the land of Onatria, which is now called Hyel. They founded this city after learning from a man of Posidonia that the Pythia's oracle had meant Caenus the hero, not the island, when she told them to found a colony there. So it went for the Phocaea in Ionia. The people of Teos did much the same as these. Once Harpagus had brought down their wall with a mound, they went aboard their vessels, every one of them, and sailed off toward Thrace. There they built the city of Abdera, a site that Timesius of Clazomene had settled earlier without success. He was chased off by the Thracians, though nowadays the Taeans of Abdera honor him as a hero. Of all the Ionians, these people alone refused to accept slavery and left their homelands. The rest of the Ionians, except the Milesians, met Harpagus in battle just as those who left had done, and each fought bravely for his own city. But being defeated and captured, they remained each in their own place and carried out what was commanded of them. The Milesians, as I have said before, having made a treaty with Cyrus himself, kept quiet. Thus, for a second time, Ionia had been enslaved. When Harpagus had subdued the Ionians on the mainland, the Ionians who held the islands, in fear of this, gave themselves up to Cyrus. Now that the Ionians had been ill-treated but were nonetheless gathering at the Panionium, I am told that Bias, a man of Preen, put forward an opinion most useful to the Ionians, one which, had they followed it, would have allowed them to be the most prosperous of the Greeks. He urged that the Ionians should set out together with a common fleet and sail to Sardinia, where they would found one single city for every Ionian, and by doing so escape their servitude and flourish, since they would be settling the largest of all islands and ruling over the rest. Whereas if they remained in Ionia, he said, he could see no lasting freedom in store for them. That was the advice Bias of Preen gave, though only after the Ionians had already met ruin. A sound proposal, though, had likewise been offered before Ionia's fall by Thales, a man from Miletus, whose family was originally Phoenician. He urged that the Ionians should have a single council chamber, and that it should be at Teos, since Teos is the center of Ionia, and that the other cities, while still inhabited, should be regarded no differently than if they were mere districts of it. These, then, were the opinions these men put forward. Harpagus, having subdued Ionia, made an expedition against the Carians, the Conians, and the Lycians, bringing Ionians and Aeolians along with him. Among these peoples, the Carians had crossed over to the mainland from the islands. Long ago, as subjects of Minos, going by the name Leleges, they occupied the islands and paid no tribute at all, as far as I can trace the matter back by report. Yet whenever Minos had need of them, they crewed his ships. Because Minos had subdued much land and was successful in war, the Carian people were by far the most renowned of all peoples at that time. And three inventions came from them, which the Greeks adopted. It was the Carians who first taught the fastening of crests onto helmets and the putting of devices onto shields, and they were the first to make hand grips for shields. Before this, all who were accustomed to use shields carried them without hand grips, guiding them by means of leather straps slung around the neck and left shoulder. Long after the Carians, the Dorians and Ionians were driven out from the islands, and thus came to the mainland. Concerning the Carians, this is the account the Cretans claim this happened. Yet the Carians themselves tell a different story, holding that they are native to the mainland and have always gone by the very name they carry today. As proof, they point to an old temple of Carian Zeus at Mylasa, where the Mysians and Lydians also take part, as being kin to the Carians, since, they say, Lydus and Mysis were brothers with Car. So these groups share in the temple, but any people who, though foreign in origin, came to speak the Carian tongue, have no part in it. As for the Conians, to my mind they are native to the land, though they themselves claim descent from Crete. Their language has drawn close to Carian, or Carian has drawn close to theirs, I cannot say for certain which, but their customs stand apart from those of other peoples, and from the Carians as well. For among them, it is considered most admirable to gather in drinking companies, according to age and friendship, men, women, and children together. And when foreign cults had been established among them, afterward, when they came to disapprove of these and resolved to keep only their ancestral gods, all the Conians of military age put on their armor, and striking the air with their spears, drove out the foreign gods all the way to the borders of Calenda, joined them, and claimed they were driving out the foreign gods. Such are the customs these people follow. As for the Lycians, they came originally out of Crete. In those early days, non-Greeks held the whole of Crete. A dispute arose in Crete over the throne between Europa's two sons, Sarpedon and Minos. Minos won out in the struggle and forced Sarpedon and his followers into exile, and the exiles made their way to the land of Milias in Asia. The country the Lycians inhabit today was in old times Milias, and the Milians were then called Salami. As long as Sarpedon ruled them, they went by the name they had brought with them, the name their neighbors still use for the Lycians today, Termoli. But when Lycus, son of Pandion, himself driven out of Athens by his brother Aegeus, came to the Termoli and joined Sarpedon, then in time they came to be called Lycians after Lycus. Their customs are partly Cretan, partly Carian. But they have one practice all their own, found among no other people in the world. They name themselves after their mothers, not their fathers. Ask a Lycian who he is, and he will recite his descent on his mother's side, reckoning back through his mother's mothers. If a citizen woman lives with a slave, the children are considered legitimate. But if a citizen man, even the foremost man among them, takes a foreign wife or concubine, the children have no standing. The Carians, then, were enslaved by Harpagus without a single notable deed to their credit, neither the Carians themselves nor any of the Greeks who live in that country. Among these are the Cnidians, colonists from Sparta. Their territory faces the sea and is called Triopium. It begins at the Bybassian Peninsula, and all of Cnidian land except a small strip is surrounded by water. On the north, the Ceramic Gulf bounds it. On the south, the sea off Syme and Rhodes. That small strip, about 5 stads across, the Cnidians set about digging through while Harpagus was subduing Ionia, wanting to turn their country into an island. The whole of it would then have lain inside, for where Cnidian territory ends at the mainland is exactly the isthmus they were cutting. The Cnidians were working with a large force, but the workmen seemed to be getting injured more often, and more uncannily, than was natural, on other parts of the body, but especially around the eyes as the rock splintered. So they sent envoys to Delphi to ask what was opposing them. The Pythia, as the Cnidians themselves tell it, gave them this answer in iambic trimeter. Do not fortify the isthmus, do not dig. Zeus would have made an island had he wished. When the Pythia delivered this, the Cnidians stopped their digging, and when Harpagus arrived with his army, they surrendered themselves without a fight. There were also the Pedasians, who lived inland above Halicarnassus. Whenever anything unwelcome was about to happen to them or to their neighbors, the priestess of Athena grew a long beard. This happened to them three times. These were the only people around Caria who held out against Harpagus for any length of time, and they gave him the most trouble, fortifying a mountain called Lyde. In time, the Pedasians were taken. As for the Lycians, when Harpagus marched his army into the plain of Xanthus, they came out to fight, few against many, and performed feats of valor. But when they were beaten and penned into their city, they gathered their wives, children, property, and household slaves into the Acropolis and set the whole Acropolis on fire. Having done that, and having sworn terrible oaths, the men of Xanthus went out and died fighting, every one of them. Of the people who call themselves Xanthian Lycians today, most, all but 80 households, are newcomers. Those 80 households happened to be away from home at the time, and so survived. That is how Harpagus took Xanthus, and he took Caunus in much the same way, for the Caunians for the most part copied the example of the Lycians. So Harpagus was laying waste to Lower Asia, while Cyrus himself dealt with the upper country, subduing every nation subduing it, sparing nothing. Most of what he did in this I will leave aside, but I will mention what cost him the greatest trouble and deserves telling above all. Once Cyrus had brought the whole mainland under his hand, he turned against the Assyrians. Assyria does have a number of other large towns, but the one most renowned and mightiest, the place where the royal residence stood once Nineveh had fallen, the royal residence, was Babylon, a city of roughly this description. It stands on a broad plain, a square in shape, each side 120 stads in length, so that the full circuit around the city comes to 480 stads altogether. Such was the extent of the Babylonian city, and it was adorned unlike any other town known to us. First, there was a ditch, deep and wide and full of water, runs around it. Then comes a wall 50 royal cubits thick and 200 cubits high, the royal cubit being three fingers longer than the common cubit. I should explain, in addition, where the earth from the moat was used and how the wall had been completed. While digging out the ditch, they shaped bricks from the soil brought up out of the trench, and once enough bricks had been fired in kilns, they set to building, using hot bitumen for mortar and laying woven reed mats between every 30th course. They first raised the banks of the trench, then the wall itself, in that same manner. Along the top of the wall, on its edges, they built single-room chambers facing one another, leaving between the chambers room enough to drive a four-horse chariot around. Set in the circuit of the wall are 100 gates, all of bronze, with bronze posts and lintels likewise. There is another city 8 days' journey from Babylon. Its name is Iz. There is a river there, not a large one. The river too is called Iz, and its current empties into the river Euphrates. This river Iz, together with its waters, also throws up a great many clumps of bitumen, and it was from there that the bitumen used on Babylon's wall was fetched. In this fashion, then, Babylon had been fortified. The city falls into two sections, split down the center by a river called the Euphrates, which runs out of Armenia, a great, deep, swift river, and it empties into the Erythraean Sea. Each of the two walls has its arms carried down to the river, and from there a breastwork of baked brick runs bending along either bank of the river. The city itself, full of houses 3 and 4 stories high, is cut through with straight streets, both the others and the cross streets that run down to the river. At each of these streets there were wicket gates in the breastwork along the river, as many in number as the lanes, and these two were of bronze, and they too opened onto the river itself. This outer wall is the city's armor, but a second wall runs around inside it, not much weaker than the other wall, though narrower. In the middle of each of the two districts of the city, a stronghold was built. In one, the royal palace within a great strong enclosure. In the other, the sanctuary of Zeus Belus with its bronze gates, still standing in my time, a square 2 stads on every side. In the middle of the sanctuary is built a solid tower, a stade in length and breadth, and on that tower stands another tower, and yet another upon that, up to 8 towers in all. The way up runs in a spiral outside, around all the towers. About halfway up the ascent, there is a landing with seats for resting, where those making the climb sit down and take a rest. In at the top of the final tower stands a great shrine, and inside it rests a large couch, handsomely made up, with a golden table set beside it. No statue stands there at all, nor does any person spend the night inside except for a single native woman, whichever one the god selects out of all of them, or so the Chaldeans claim, they being priests of this god. These same men also claim, though I find it hard to credit, that the god himself comes into the shrine and takes his rest on the couch, exactly as happens, they say, at Egyptian Thebes, according to the Egyptians. There too a woman sleeps in the shrine of the Theban Zeus, and in both cases the women are said to have no intercourse with any man. The same is true of the prophetess of the god at Patera in Lycia, when there is one, for the oracle is not always active there, but when there is one, she is shut in with the god at night inside the temple. In the sanctuary at Babylon there is also another temple below, where there is a great seated image of Zeus, made of gold, and beside it a great golden table. The pedestal and the throne are also gold. As the Chaldeans told it, these things were made from 800 talents of gold. Outside the temple is a golden altar, and there is also another great altar, on which the full-grown sheep are sacrificed. For on the golden altar, only unweaned animals may be offered, and on of the greater altar, and every year the Chaldeans burn 1,000 talents of frankincense on it, at the time when they hold the festival for this god. In that sacred precinct there was still standing, at that time, a solid gold statue 12 cubits high. I myself did not see it. I report what is said by the Chaldeans. Darius, son of Hystaspes, plotted against this statue, but did not dare to take it, though Xerxes, son of Darius, did take it, and killed the priest who forbade him to move the statue. This is how that temple is adorned, and there are also many private dedications. Of this Babylon there were, of course, many other kings as well, whom I will mention in my account of Assyrian affairs, kings who added to the walls and the temples, and among them also two women. The first to rule, who lived 5 generations before the later one, was named Semiramis. She it was who left behind the embankments across the plain, a sight worth seeing, before that the river used to flood the whole plain. The second of these queens, named Nitocris, was even more shrewd than the woman who had ruled before her. She left behind, for one thing, the monuments I shall describe, and for another, seeing that the empire of the Medes was great and restless, and that among other cities they had already taken Nineveh, she took every precaution she could. First, the Euphrates River, which used to flow straight and runs through the middle of the city, this she made so crooked by digging channels above the city that it now reaches, in its course, one of the villages in Assyria 3 times over. The village which the Euphrates reaches is called Ardareka. And even now those who travel from the sea to Babylon, sailing down the Euphrates, arrive at this same village 3 times, and after 3 days. This is one thing she did, and she also built up an embankment along each bank of the river, remarkable for its size and height. Far above Babylon she dug out a basin for a lake, running a short distance out from the river, digging it always to the depth of the water table, and making its circumference 2,400 stadia. The earth dug out from this excavation she used, heaping it up along the banks of the river. When it had been dug out, she brought stones and built a coping around it all the way round. She did both of these things, made the river crooked and the whole excavation a marsh, so that the river would be slower as it broke around many bends, and so that the routes to Babylon would be crooked, and after these winding routes, there would follow a long circuit around the lake. She carried out this work on that side of the country where the entrances lay and the shortest routes from Media, so that the Medes, by mingling with her people, might not learn about her affairs. These defenses she built up from the depths of the ground, and she also added the following work to them. Since the city was in 2 sections, with the river running between them, under the earlier kings, whenever anyone wished to cross from one section to the other, he had to cross by boat, which was, I suppose, a nuisance. But she foresaw this as well. For when she dug the basin for the lake, she left behind another monument from this same work. She had very long stones cut, And once the stones lay ready and the basin had been dug out, she turned the whole current of the river aside into the hollow she had excavated. While that filled, the old riverbed dried up in the meantime, and during that time she rebuilt the river's banks along the city with fired brick, along with the stairways running down from the small gates to the river, matching same plan as the wall. And then, roughly in the middle of the city, with the stones she had quarried, she built a bridge, binding the stones together with iron and lead. Across it, she used to lay, whenever day came, squared timbers, on which the Babylonians made their crossing. But at night these timbers were removed, for this reason, so that people would not go back and forth in the night stealing from one another. When the excavated basin had become a full lake fed by the river, and the work on the bridge had been finished, she brought the Euphrates back from the lake into its old channel. And so the marsh that had been dug turned out, as she had planned, to be useful, and the citizens had a bridge built for them. This same queen also devised the following kind of trick. Above the busiest of the city's gates, she had a tomb built for herself, raised high above the gates themselves, and she had inscribed on the tomb letters saying this: "If any king of Babylon after me is short of money, let him open this tomb and take as much money as he wishes, but let him not open it otherwise, unless he is in want. It will not be for the better." This tomb remained undisturbed until the kingship passed to Darius. To Darius, it seemed a terrible thing to make no use of these gates, and though money lay there and the inscription itself invited him not to take it, he made no use of these gates for this reason, that the corpse would be over his head as he drove through. When he opened the tomb, he found not money, but the body itself, together with an inscription reading: "Had you not been greedy for wealth and shameless in your grasping, you would never have broken open the tombs of the dead." Such, it is told, was the character of this queen. Now it was against the son of this very woman that Cyrus led his army, a son bearing his own father's name, Labantus, along with the rule over the Assyrians. When the great king takes the field, he does so amply supplied from home with food and livestock, and along with these he carries water drawn from the river Chospes, the stream that runs by Susa. The king drinks from no river but that one. This Chospes water, once boiled, is hauled behind him by a great number of four-wheeled mule wagons bearing it in silver jars, following wherever he happens to march at any time. Now when Cyrus, marching against Babylon, came to the river Ginz, whose sources are in the Mashanian Mountains, and which flows through the country of the Dardanians and empties into another river, the Tigris, which in turn flows past the city of Opis and empties into the Red Sea. When Cyrus tried to cross this river Ginz, since it was navigable by boats, then one of the sacred white horses, in his wantonness, plunged into the river and tried to cross it. But the river swept him under and carried him off. Cyrus was furious with the river for this act of insolence, and threatened to make it so weak that in the future even women would cross it easily without wetting their knees. After this threat, he set aside his campaign against Babylon and divided his army in two. Having divided it, he marked out with cords and laid out 180 straight channels running in every direction from each bank of the Ginz, and having arranged his army along them, he ordered them to dig. Since a great multitude was at work, the task was completed, yet even so they spent that entire summer working there. When he had exacted his revenge on the river Ginz by cutting it up into 360 channels, and with the second spring now coming on, he then marched on Babylon. The Babylonians came out and took up positions, awaiting him. When his advance brought him near the city, the Babylonians engaged him in battle, but, beaten in the encounter, they were driven back and penned inside the town. Since they had long since realized that Cyrus was not content to stay still, but saw him attacking every nation alike, they had stored up provisions for very many years. So they took no account whatsoever of the siege, while Cyrus was caught in perplexity, since a great deal of time was passing and his affairs were making no further progress. Whether someone else suggested it to him in his perplexity, or he himself understood what he had to do, he did the following. He stationed his whole army at the point where the river enters the city, and behind the city he stationed others at the point where the river flows out of it, and he told his troops that as soon as they saw the channel become passable, they should enter the city there. Having arranged his forces and given these instructions, he himself marched off with the useless part of his army. Once he reached the lake, Cyrus carried out the very works the Babylonian queen had made along the river and around the lake. He cut a channel and led the river into the lake, at that time a marsh, so that the old bed became fordable as the water level fell. With this accomplished, the Persians stationed there for just this purpose, at that very point, along the channel of the Euphrates, now that it had dropped to about the middle of a man's thigh, entered Babylon by this route. Now if the Babylonians had learned beforehand, or had found out, what Cyrus was doing, they would have let the Persians enter and then destroyed them most miserably. For by shutting all the little gates leading to the river and climbing up onto the embankments raised along the riverbanks by the little gates, would have trapped the enemy as though in a net. As matters turned out, though, the Persians caught them off guard entirely. And owing to the sheer size of the city, so those who dwell there report, once the outer districts had already fallen, the Babylonians living at the center had no idea learned that the city had been taken. But because they happened to be holding a festival at that very time, they went on dancing and enjoying themselves until they learned the full truth. And that is how Babylon was captured on that first occasion. As for the resources of the Babylonians, I will show how great they are by many other proofs, and also by this one. For the great king himself and his army, the whole land under his rule is divided up for their support, apart from the tribute. Now since there are 12 months in the year, the land of Babylon feeds him for 4 of those months, and the rest of Asia for the other 8. So the Assyrian land is a third as strong, in resources, as the whole of the rest of Asia. And the governorship of this land, which the Persians call a satrapy, is by far the strongest of all the governorships, seeing that Triton Teachum, son of Artabazus, who held this province from the king, received every single day a full artaba of silver. Now the artaba is a Persian measure, and holds 3 Attic chonixes more than an Attic medimnos. He also kept horses of his own, apart from the war horses, 800 stallions and 16,000 mares, since each stallion serviced 20 mares. And so vast a pack of Indian hounds was maintained that 4 large villages on the plain, freed from every other tax, were charged solely with feeding the dogs. Such were the resources available to the governor of Babylon. Now Assyria receives little rainfall, and it is that scant rain which feeds the grain's root. But it is by being irrigated from the river that the crop is brought to fullness, and the grain comes to maturity, not as in Egypt, where the river itself rises over the fields, but here it is watered by hand and by swingbeam devices. For the whole land of Babylon, like that of Egypt, is cut through by canals, and the largest of these canals is navigable by ships. It runs toward the winter sunrise and connects with another river, from the Euphrates to the Tigris, on whose banks the city of Nineveh once stood. This is, of all the lands we know, by far the best for producing the fruit of Demeter. Indeed, it does not even attempt to bear other trees at all, neither fig, nor vine, nor olive. But for producing the fruit of Demeter, it is so good that it regularly yields 200-fold, and when it bears at its very best, it yields 300-fold. There the blades of the wheat and barley plants grow easily 4 fingers broad. As for how tall a plant millet and sesame grow to, though I know well, I will not record it, being well aware that to those who have not visited the land of Babylon, even what has already been said about its crops has met with a great deal of disbelief. They use no oil at all, except what they make from sesame. They have date palms growing throughout the whole plain, most of them fruit-bearing, from which they make food, wine, and honey. They tend these in the same way as figs, and in particular, as regards the palms the Greeks call male, they tie the fruit of these onto the fruit-bearing palms, so that the gall insect may enter the fruit and ripen it, and so that the fruit of the palm does not fall off. For the male palms carry the gall insect in their fruit, just as wild figs do. But the greatest wonder of all among the things there, next to concerning the city, I will now turn to describe. Their boats, those that come down the river to Babylon, are round in shape and made entirely of hide. Cutting willow ribs among the Armenians settled farther upstream than the Assyrians, they stretch skins over the frame as an outer covering, forming something like a floor, without shaping a distinct stern or bow, but making the whole thing round like a shield. Then, after loading it up, the whole boat with straw, they let it drift down the river, loaded with cargo, most often with palmwood jars full of wine. It is steered by 2 paddles and 2 men standing upright, one pulling his paddle inward and the other pushing his outward. These boats are made both very large and smaller. The largest of them, they set the whole boat loose to drift downriver, filled with cargo, mostly jars of palm wine brought down for sale. Two steering oars guide it, worked by two men standing upright, one pulling his oar inward while the other pushes his outward. These boats are made in sizes both very large and smaller. The biggest of them can hold a cargo of 5,000 talents. Each boat carries a live donkey aboard, and the larger ones carry several. So once they have sailed down and reached Babylon and sold off their cargo, they put the boat's ribs and all its straw up for sale, load the hides onto the donkeys, and drive back to the Armenians, since heading upriver is simply not possible in any way, given how swift the current runs, which is exactly why the boats are built from hides rather than timber. Once they get back to Armenian country, driving their donkeys ahead of them, they build fresh boats the same way. Such, then, is the design of their boats. As for clothing, this is what they wear: a linen tunic that reaches down to the feet and over for anyone to carry a staff without an emblem. Such, then, is their arrangement as regards the body. As for their customs, they are established as follows. The wisest of them, in my judgment, is this one, which I understand the Aneti of Illyria also practice. In each village, once a year, they used to do the following. Whenever the girls reached marriageable age, they would gather all of them together and bring them to one place, assembling them in a group. And around them stood a crowd of men, and a herald would stand each girl up in turn and put her up for sale, first the most beautiful of all of them. Then, once she had been sold for a large sum of gold, he would announce another, the one who was next most beautiful, and they would be sold for marriage. As many of the wealthy Babylonians as were eligible for marriage would outbid one another for the most beautiful girls. But as many as were of the common people and eligible for marriage had no need of good looks, since these men would take money along with plainer girls. For once the herald had gone through selling off the most beautiful of the girls, he would then stand up the ugliest one, or one who was crippled, if there were any, and put her up for sale as well, offering her to whoever was willing to take the least amount of gold and live with her, until she went to whoever undertook to accept the least. And the gold for this came from the beautiful girls, so that in this way, the good-looking girls provided dowries for the ugly and the crippled ones. But a man was not permitted to give his own daughter to whomever he wished, nor could the purchaser take the girl away without a guarantor. Instead, the buyer had to provide guarantors that he would indeed live with her, and only then take her away. And if the two did not get along, the law required that the money be given back. It was also permitted for anyone who wished, coming from another village, to buy a wife in this way. Now this was the finest of their customs, but it does not continue to exist today. Instead, they have recently devised something else, so as to prevent the men from mistreating the women or taking them off to another city. For since they were conquered and reduced to hardship and their households ruined, everyone among the common people who is short of livelihood now prostitutes his female children. Second in wisdom is this other custom established among them. They carry the sick out into the marketplace, since they have no physicians at all. People passing by approach the sick man and offer advice about his illness, if they themselves have ever suffered anything like what the sick man has, or have seen another person suffer it. Approaching him in this way, they advise him and urge upon him whatever remedies they themselves used to sell their daughters into prostitution. A second custom they hold in high regard is this: they carry the sick out into the marketplace, since they have no use for physicians. Passers-by then approach the sick person and offer advice about the illness, whether from having suffered something similar themselves or from having watched another go through it. They come forward with such counsel, urging whatever course they themselves followed both of them bathe, for they will touch no vessel before they have bathed. The Arabians do this same thing as well. But the most shameful of the customs among the Babylonians is this one. Every native woman is required, once in her life, to sit in the sanctuary of Aphrodite and have intercourse with a strange man. Many women, disdaining to mingle with the others because they are proud of their wealth, ride out to the sanctuary in covered carriages drawn by teams of horses and stand there. A large retinue of attendants follows behind them. But most of the women do as follows. They sit in the precinct of Aphrodite wearing a wreath of cord around their heads, many women, for some are arriving while others are leaving. Rope-stretched passageways run in every direction through the midst of the women, along which the strangers pass and make their choice. And once a woman has taken her seat there, she may not return home until one of the strangers has thrown silver into her lap and had intercourse with her outside the sanctuary. And as he throws the money, he must say these words, "I call upon the goddess Mylitta on your behalf." The Assyrians call Aphrodite Mylitta.